Log Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, breaking news. Wisconsin garners 1 million signatures to recall Governor Scott Walker. More breaking news. Virginia Appellate Court has rejected Rick Perry's appeal to be on the Virginia ballot. The South Carolina primary run is down one candidate. Is the worst yet to come? Congress comes back to the worst approval numbers ever. This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. Radio's premier talk show broadcast from a cigar lounge in Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live from Philly's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As they are every Tuesday, we'll go around the table. I am Justin Russell, your moderator for Backroom Politics. To my left, he is the former 8-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is the former vice president of government affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is Congressman Al Smith. Congressman, welcome back.
All right, guys.
And to my 11 o'clock, as he is every Tuesday, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce. He is a former longtime Senate staffer, and he has served under, last count was 4 presidents, Alan?
Close enough.
He's the Honorable Alan Moore. Alan, how you doing?
I'm well.
Welcome back. And to my 12 o'clock, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, how are you?
Glad to be here.
Good to have you back. And back from Hawaii, he is the vice president for China affairs for the Eurasia Center. He is a bar certified attorney in the District of Columbia. And the great city of New York, he is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Wow, welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be back with everyone.
Great to have you back here. There is a lot of news going on here in Washington, D.C. So much we have to talk about. Let's go ahead and kick it off with the breaking news coming out of Wisconsin. Apparently, the recall or the effort to recall Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin has succeeded with over 1 million signatures, which is about 460,000 more than they needed to get the recall initiative going. That is huge, and it should be a very big wake-up call for a lot of people in governor's mansions across the country. The big push on Scott Walker has been the issue to eliminate collective bargaining in the state, as well as some other austerity measures, in his words, that needed to be implemented there in Madison. But this has got to be a wake-up call for just about every Republican governor out there. Bob, how big of a deal is this?
Well, it's a very big deal. I mean, the fact that they've got almost twice as many signatures as they need, it tells you how serious and how strong the labor movement has decided to make a stand here in Wisconsin, which is a good place to make a stand for as far as a state. And it's going to send the kind of a message that says, in effect, hey, guys, you know, you can you got to work with us. You can't just, pass laws that limit our rights to collective bargaining, limit our rights on pensions and other benefits. On a whim, you're going to have to deal with us, and if you don't, we will take retribution. And it's pretty clear to me that the governor is in very shaky shape.
Al, as a Democrat, you've got some thoughts on this, obviously.
Well, yes, but I would add to what Bob said. But this is not your typical case of where a governor has got to do some very tough things that are going to make him or her very unpopular. He went out and picked a fight.
Yep.
I mean, he played the Grinch. It was done in a mean-spirited way with a lot of nasty rhetoric, which ended up going both directions. And so he doing what he did was dangerous. The way he did it was a killer.
Yep.
Alan, you've got to you've got to be hearing the cheers coming from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the AFL-CIO, AFSCME, and the other large labor unions. Is this more of an issue of union or big labor is flexing its muscles, or is this a sign to other governors that, look, extreme austerity measures in one time, in one place, just aren't going to work and we're tired of it?
Well, it's definitely a comment about big labor getting involved. You don't get that many signatures without a lot of organized effort. Would that Rick Perry and Newt Gingrich would have had organization like that and trying to get signatures in Virginia, and they might have been on the ballot.
We'll talk about that in a second.
But having said that, whether this is a message to other governors, I wouldn't read too much into this particular one. I think as Al and Bob have suggested here, it was a pretty unusual case in Wisconsin. The groundwork was not laid for what the governor tried to do, but he found himself with majorities in the legislature in the state that were willing to take this on. But they infuriated a lot of people at the time, and that gave the unions and other organizers a stronger, better opportunity to go get these signatures. So I don't think that this particular case means a great deal. And I will remind everybody that this doesn't settle anything. This means they got a lot of signatures, and this will be put to a ballot measure, and ultimately voters will decide this, not signature gatherers.
Al?
Yeah, he's not gone yet. What I was going to say, and I learned this from John Dingell when we were dealing with some national railroad strikes when I was chairman of the railroad subcommittee. And John pointed out, he said, there are two things that you never do to organize labor. You never attack their right to organize. You never attack their right to strike. And he said, there are all kinds of ways around those things. To sit down and say, we've got to cut costs. And maybe we've got to consider some layoffs, maybe we've got to consider some pay reductions, begin a dialogue in that kind of a fashion, and organized labor would have been very unhappy, but they probably would have come to the table and at least talked.
Well, we talked about this issue with Scott Walker. I mean, literally, Governor Walker took this issue on within weeks of being inaugurated into the governor's office, and as a result had literally hundreds of thousands of big labor supporters in the rotunda outside the Capitol. You would have thought that would have been a message to Scott Walker. But to Scott Walker's credit, he held firm on his position. He didn't waver at all, Bob.
Well, and remind yourself, this is we can all go back and think about it last year, when early in the year, Democratic senators took off. They left the city. They even left the state.
They went to Illinois, correct?
Absolutely. They in effect, were trying to avoid any possibility of a vote. I mean, that's how serious it was. And it's just a question of, I think we said it before, there are ways to do these things. I mean, it may well be that you can Walker can think he had a great victory, but it's going to be very pyrrhic, I believe.
Well, and I think the message is, when you're in power, you have to build an effective coalition between business and labor in order to get things done. And it's very surprising because many people in Wisconsin were getting sick and tired of all the electioneering, but at the same time, they recognized how important collective bargaining issues were.
Well, I'd quibble just a little bit, Justin, with your defining him as courageous or sticking to it. If what you're doing is setting your feet in concrete for something that's stupid, I'm not sure you should get much credit for that.
Bob? Well, normally what happens when you put your feet in concrete, cut concrete, they throw you in the river.
And I think that's what's about to happen.
Alan?
I can't help but, reminding everybody that there were a lot more signatures than expected. But this issue is not over and done with. This will be a battle royal. And you can get a lot of signatures. You go to a union hall meeting, everybody will sign. But if you're in a private company and a union, you may resent public employees along with a lot of the population, you'll sign, but that doesn't mean you'll vote that way. So the reason that they could pull this off was that there was a lot of resentment, not only in Wisconsin but elsewhere, about the pay and privileges of public employees. It's very unfortunate that they have become the targets. But just because you got a bunch of signatures on a recall petition doesn't mean you know what the outcome is.
I completely agree with Alan on that. The time to pop the corks is not yet.
But you have a very, very almost inflated number of people that would expect that were expected to sign up for the recall vote, or at least to call the recall vote. But you also have a very, very powerful Democratic Party chairman in Mike Tate in Wisconsin. He came out and said, when the numbers were released, and I quote, "An incredible number of Wisconsinites have stood up to be counted and say we can't wait for the next election. We must absolutely get Scott Walker out of office." You know that that is going to move forward into the Democratic ranks throughout the state. That's going to drive a strong Democrat to come in and possibly retake the governor's mansion.
What are the rules there? Do they have to throw him out first before they can elect somebody else?
I'm not sure about Wisconsin. It may be a similar situation where they may put up a candidate and have him, you know, as a recall vote. Do you wish to recall?
Like Schwarzenegger
did in 2003, correct?
But at the end of the day, can they bring people out to the polls? Because Wisconsin has been in an election mode for over 2 years now with all this, and people are getting tired.
Well, on the flip side of this, you have to look at it, is can big labor get the vote out?
Right.
You can get the signatures at a union hall. Can you get the vote out? And I think that falls solely on Democratic Party Chairman in Wisconsin, Mike Tate's shoulders.
Sure.
But the big issue here, though, is that you are looking at initiatives in Indiana. You've got Mitch Daniels having an issue with his governorship in Indiana. You've got you've got the governor of Florida, who is now going to start pushing similar issues that we found in Wisconsin down in Florida to roll back collective bargaining for public employees. If this kind of recall can happen in a state like Wisconsin, is Indiana and Florida the next big battlefront? Alan?
I don't know. I just think that it's very dangerous to overdraw the implications of what was a unique set of circumstances in Wisconsin. So I
think the governor of Indiana is sensible.
It's a lot smarter in the way he does business.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, there's been similar protests in Indiana.
Much smaller, though. Indiana is not Wisconsin. Indiana is a much more conservative state than Wisconsin.
Is it a right-to-work state? Does that have an effect?
No, but they're trying to push. What they're trying to push in Indiana is legislation for right to work to be bestowed in Indiana. But the bigger question is this a resurgence of the union movement?
Now, I don't think it's a resurgence of the union movement. I think what it is a statement from the union movement that you have crossed the line we will not accept. You're saying you're taking away our right to collective bargaining, and you can tell us what the deal is, and that ain't going to work. I think Al said it very well at the beginning. You can't cross some lines. You've got to. When you start talking about the collective bargaining rights, you're talking about the most fundamental right of an organized union. Period. And that's the bottom line.
Alan, all right, Alan.
It's one thing to debate, you know, pensions and other things like that, because everybody knows we got a lot of problems. But this is different. This is saying we're taking your rights away, just period. We're not negotiating cutting on benefits.
Alan?
What was unique about Wisconsin is it happened very quickly, and there was this sense that they took advantage of an opportunity and rammed something down the throats of the legislature and the public. That's not what's happening in Indiana and in Florida. It's a more measured, time-consuming process. Doesn't mean there isn't a lot of passion about it, but it's hard to to villainize the governor of either state for pushing something, taking initiative that hasn't occurred yet, then, if you will, taking advantage right out of the box after election, using the new legislature, and literally cramming it in the minds of those who didn't like it, cramming it down their throats. So, but here again, there has to be, the electorate will speak down the road, and this is just a step in the process.
When we look at a conflict like what's happening in Wisconsin, is there something that we can take from what's happening in Wisconsin and maybe look down the road, maybe to the 2012 election? Is this going to be something that says, look, we don't want to alienate big labor, Al?
I think no one wants to go out and offend big labor. Sometimes you have to, either because of your philosophical standing or because you're running into a problem. And it's always dangerous to do that. And the teachers' union is another one. But, excuse me. But, as Alan says, there's a long way to go before we can tell how much of this is filtering down to Joe Blow when he goes into the polls.
Well, what Walker has done is effectively energize the Democratic base, which was dormant for a while. But with his actions, he's really got everyone fired up and ready to go, knock on doors, and elect Democrats.
Now,
if the Occupy organization was organized, this in certain states could be a huge issue for them to concentrate on and tie it in with Wall Street and all of that.
Sure.
I don't know that anybody has to worry too much about that. I find them rather ineffective.
Well, we can downplay this, but let's also remind ourselves, 460,000 more signatures than they needed, because they were only required to have about 500,000 signatures, and they got almost double that, is a big statement. I mean, this single-handedly makes it the largest recall movement in history, or in modern history, larger than the Gray Davis recall vote where Arnold Schwarzenegger came into Sacramento. That has got to be something that we've got to look at and say the voters, at least the Democratic voters in Wisconsin, are tired of the extreme austerity measures or the extreme positions that the Republicans in Madison are taking.
The other thing it's going to do is it's going to alert, it's going to energize organized labor in states where this isn't the issue, but where just the fact that organized labor has been attacked will probably help them get yard signs out, help them...
it could happen here. We better be proactive. That's what will happen.
Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, what do you think this is going to do for the Obama White House? Is this going to be a big surge for them? Is this something that they're going to grasp onto and start making this a national effort? Or is this something they're going to say, let's wait and see what happens in Wisconsin and we'll take it from there?
I'll bet they'll say, let's wait and see what happens. And because they will be listening to Alan's advice, I think.
Alan?
Yeah.
Well, if they're listening,
we don't want to put you on the hot seat or anything, Alan, but go ahead.
I hadn't realized that Alan had become a Democratic strategist.
Well,
remember, as I understand it, this recall election will occur sometime probably in June.
Correct.
So it's not as though it's going to dovetail with the election in November. That's the first point. Second point, there has to be an opponent. So the voters will speak, but you don't beat somebody with nobody. We've learned that over and over and over again in politics. When you think you got a vulnerable candidate or a vulnerable incumbent, we saw that with George W. Bush just a few years ago.
Well, there
when everybody thought that he would lose, and he beat John Kerry handily. Now. So here we've got this situation coming up. There's a lot of time between now and then. The groups that big labor will have a big say in who the candidate to oppose Walker will be, and there's no guarantee that it will be someone that will rally the voters. So you may, it's one thing to go around to meetings and say, sign this petition and get admittedly a huge number of people to sign. That, A, doesn't mean they'll vote. B, it doesn't mean they'll vote for the new guy.
Well, there's already names being floated around in the Democratic race. One of them is the Dane County county executive, a woman by the name of Kathleen Falk, and the other one is longtime Democratic Senator Tim Cullen. Those are two names that are being floated right now as being possible contenders for. And the Democratic Party seems to believe that those are people that will garner. They've got enough name recognition inside the state. They've got enough support from a strong Democratic base that's energized off this recall movement. Those could be your two possible contenders for the governor's mansion.
Well, you may have a couple of contenders, which would be, makes it interesting, too. I know nothing about Wisconsin politics. So if that hasn't been obvious, I will state it. For those handful of people who didn't get that in the first time around. But I've been around a while. I've watched things happen, and there's an orderly process that has to occur. And getting a recall petition, the signatures, that's a big deal. Actually recalling somebody, it rarely happens.
Well, it's only happened twice in American history.
It's not unprecedented. Maybe this will be the next time, but we have to wait and see.
Ow.
I think there's another aspect to this. This will have alerted labor all over the country because it's one of those two key fundamental issues to organized labor. That means that in a state like mine, for example, where the machinists union, which is huge because of Boeing, they don't have an international trade agreement with Mexico to scream about and organize around. They can organize and enthuse their members just over these fundamentals, and that's going to play on the Democratic candidates that are running and play against the fear that the Tea Party and others might be putting into some of those Democrats.
The other thing we have to look at is this is not necessarily a partisan issue. If you look at what's happening in Indiana in Mitch Daniels' governorship, a brand new organization called Lunch Pail Republicans, which tend to be your middle class, blue collar, they tend to be union members, but they tend to vote Republican. This Lunch Pail Republican movement is taking hold to the extent that Republicans, including Republican state senators in Indiana, are backing the movement to not go right to work. One state senator I observed the other day came out in Indiana and said, look, we have to have unions to represent the best interests of everybody involved, both the state taxpayers and those who provide services to the state as employees. So there's going to be a Republican movement that's in this. That's something that we got to be concerned about, and especially like a kind of a purplish, not a red, not a blue state like Wisconsin. Bob?
Well, there is no doubt that in America, the reality is that the unions have a legitimate place in the political process. They do protect unions. They protect their members. Sometimes they are, particularly in the public unions, they have gotten far too strong in the ability to manipulate Democratic governors and legislators, and that's the reason that so many states are in serious trouble. But that said, there's a difference between arguing about pensions, and there's a difference between arguing about the size of the pay increase automatically every year. But when you start talking about the right to organize, you are in effect saying we are going to be in a position to destroy the unions, and that is not going to work, and it shouldn't.
And when they had the last recall elections in Wisconsin, you had many people that came from all over the country just to go down there and help the Democratic Party organize and get people to the polls.
Which recall?
The Senate, the state senators.
That was in response to the initial movement
right.
of Governor Walker.
But you got people from all over the country that were going out there because they're very concerned about labor rights being
correct. Alan.
Yeah, we touched on it earlier, but I've reflecting on it further, there is an issue that we don't understand very well among the union members. And Al, you work with them hand to hand over the years, and maybe you can speak to this. But I see a difference between private sector unions and public sector unions. And here's the difference that I see. The private sector union member, the lunch pail Democrat and Republican who works in a company that might or might not survive, that might or might not grow, sees himself and herself as the employer of public sector employees and their unions. And one of the things we saw in the decline of the economy was a lot of resentment for the employment privileges, the pay, and the pension rights that public employees have that they are paying for. So there's this conflict that occurs that you don't see among the private sector unions pitted against each other, but this is the private employee versus the public employee. And what we don't yet know is if there is a recall election, there will probably be a lot of ugly accusation about the rights and privileges that public employees receive that the rest of the public pays for, and it could affect how people actually vote.
I would argue that would be true if, in fact, what this was about was pensions or raising prices. I can see the machinist sitting out something over the public employees' benefits. But I come back to the point. This attacks their right to organize, which has to affect their right to strike. Those two things will energize organized labor, I think, across this
across the
acknowledged
country.
Gap that let's look at one fact though.
I mean, when you talk about, you know, this idea that there's almost animosity towards the pension system that they have, we've seen a lot of states where there's had to be some give and take between the public employees unions and the state itself, notably the negotiations that Governor Chris Christie did in New Jersey with all the public sector unions. Everybody came to the table with the exception of the American Federation of Teachers. They all came in. They said, look, if we have to give up some in the way of pension benefits, in the way of medical benefits, if we have to, we're willing to do that for the sustainability and the survivability of the state as a whole. They're not unreasonable when it comes to those type of facts, and we also have to look at the private sector. I mean, let's be real. Everybody claims the bailout was what kept the American auto industry working. In reality, some could argue that it was the UAW coming to the table saying, look, we'll take the hit to make sure a majority of our members are still employed and have benefits down the road. You know, how do you balance that argument? Bob, can you?
Well, I mean, the auto industry deal was a little bit different. I mean, you know, remind yourself, the bondholders of Chrysler and GM took a huge haircut, and the unions got the ownership. I mean, you know, it was a Democratic administration playing to their friends, very much so. Now, that's, you know,
well, the bailout was initiated by the Bush administration.
Sure it was.
So,
but the deal was, when the deal was finally cut, that's what happened. It's not a question of who did it, which administration. It's a question of the strength of the unions, and that's what they got.
But
there's, you know, my point is, it's a little bit different in the private sector, and the unions were very successful there. I would have done a little bit differently, I think, but nonetheless, it was a reasonable deal. And the unions are now, the unions have a significant ownership.
Well, they have skin in the game now. It's in their
that's
interest
right.
to make sure that the company
yeah,
is
and
profitable.
That's a plus. That's a plus.
Do you think that it's in the best interest of the public sector employee unions to just make sure that there is a sustainable budget to move forward in the state just to keep them either A, employed, or keep the state solvent?
Absolutely. You know, if the state goes bankrupt, you know, what happens to their pension plans? What happens to their, you know, their employee rights? You know, they disappear too, pretty much. Once you go bankrupt, you know, you're going into court. All those kinds of things are basically under the control of a bankruptcy court rather than a negotiation. That's a big
deal. We've got a caller on the line. Caller, you're on the air with Backroom Politics. What's your comment?
How you doing?
Fine.
Well, I'd like to say that while these issues are certainly important, without addressing the root problems, they don't really go anywhere, and it resembles kind of a dog who's chasing his tail. And what I mean by that is, first of all, both political parties in this country are essentially the same when it comes to issues that matter the most. And all one has to do is just, you know, go back and look at who opened the door for free trade, who expanded it further, Clinton, Bush, Obama, who started the war in the Middle East, who expanded it, and so forth. Healthcare, same thing. The bottom line is that the issue that's not being addressed by anyone in the media, by the politicians, the issues they want to stay away from, that is the issues that have destroyed this country, free trade, and the lack of a real universal healthcare system. Because if we're going to have an open system of trade with our trading partners, we have to have a similar economic infrastructure. And that means we have to have a universal healthcare system like our trading partners do. Otherwise, corporations are going to continue to send jobs overseas because it's less costly to do so, but they don't have to pay for healthcare. In addition to that, of course, universal healthcare has been proven to have better results and to have lower costs, similar to the argument between pension plans or the defined benefit portion of the pension plans, the income portion, versus 401ks. 401ks have lower returns and they're more costly. Why? Because they're in the retail market, similar to universal health care. Universal health care is not in the retail market. It's more you have the middleman that's taken out of it.
Do you think, caller, do you think that, that the public employees going to a universal health care would have more of a leg to stand on than, let's say, if a state went to a private market factor?
Oh, the problem with not having universal health care is that it's more expensive, the labor costs are more expensive, first of all, and therefore it encourages corporations to send jobs overseas, right, where they don't have to pay for health care. And there's other costs, of course. There's retirement costs, and there's also regulatory costs. And the only thing that people are hearing from Washington is they want to attack the regulatory burden in this country. They want to get rid of OSHA and the EPA, which is ridiculous. Where they want us to be like China, where they're all dying of cancer because of hexane exposure through their Apple products that they're making. People don't know what's going on over in China. I certainly do. We need certain regulatory statutes that protect consumers, that protect the workers, right? We need certain things. The key issue is if these oligarchs want to have this whole globalization baloney, then they need to have all the member nations that are in the trading agreements, they need to abide by similar economic rules. Otherwise, you're going to have disparities. And in America's case, it means that wealth and incomes are going to be shifted in two places, from the middle class, from the working class, to the wealthy elite who own the corporations, and to developing countries, emerging countries. This is why the living standards of China, India, Brazil, and developing Asia have increased tremendously over the past several years. This is why corporate profits are just below record highs, right? Where is all that money coming from? It's coming from the working class and the middle class. And these are irrefutable facts that I actually wrote about 5 years ago and was banned by the media.
Right. Well, caller, where are you calling from, by the way?
Calling from Texas.
Great. Well, caller, we appreciate you listening in. We're up on the break right now. But we ask that you continue to listen in and call in any time. Thanks for your call. Caller's got a couple of interesting points. I mean,
it's a very thoughtful presence. It's one that people can argue with, but it's a well thought out and consistent point of view that he laid out.
I mean, you know, this is something that has been argued about. You know, are we competitive with having private market healthcare in the mix for even public sector employees? I mean, that's something that's an argument that's going to continue on down the road. No question about it. We're up against the break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk about the other breaking news coming out of Richmond, Virginia, which is Governor Rick Perry's attempt to get on the ballot for the Republican primary in Virginia has been shut down again by an appellate court. We'll talk about that and the ramifications when we come back. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. Talk about the other breaking news coming out of Virginia right now, and that news is that Governor Rick Perry, his lawsuit to get on the Republican primary ballot has been shut down in the appellate courts of the Commonwealth of Virginia. It looks like right now that this will also affect Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum's efforts to join. They also joined the Rick Perry lawsuit. John Huntsman was also attached to that lawsuit. He has since withdrawn from the GOP presidential race. But it basically is a decisive blow to the Perry campaign in particular and the Gingrich campaign to not be able to get their name on the ballot. The Perry challenge was against the state's ballot laws, which requires 10,000 signatures, 400 from each, a minimum of 400 in each of the congressional districts in Virginia. As of December 27th, Gingrich, Santorum, and Huntsman, and Perry all fail to meet that requirement, ergo, not on the primary ballot. This is going to get a lot of people's attention. Now, the lawsuit outside of that, you would think that a strong campaign organization would have known and would have been head first into getting those signatures on the ballot. Al, you got a thought on that?
Absolutely. You know, if I could wave a wand and change Virginia's laws, I would do so because I think they're too strict. But they were well known. They've been around for a long time. Anybody running a campaign ought to know what they have to do. And my question is, what the hell were they doing instead of collecting signatures? So I have no patience with them at all.
Well, they got in kind of late. I mean, Romney had built an effective organization, started a couple of years ago, and he had the time to focus on that. But Gingrich and Perry sort of came in later on, and their biggest weakness is they don't have an effective state-run organization.
But you also look at Ron Paul managed to get on the state. Right now, the Virginia GOP primary ballot is Mitt Romney and Ron Paul. Ron Paul's organization managed to meet the requirement. In fact, you know, if you look at some of the quotes coming out of the ruling, which we'll get to here in a second, the courts are saying, look, you knew about it, you should have done something about it, whether you're late to the game or not. The state of Virginia has allowed some complete long-shot oddball Republicans to come on the ballot. If you're a front-runner, you should at least know to get your name and get the 10,000 signatures. Bob?
Yeah, agreed. But we were talking just a few moments ago about, you know, Gingrich and Santorum and Perry, you know, being late to the game and whatnot, and not having maybe as much money or troops on the ground to be able to do it. And then again, notice who got on. The guy with plenty of money, Romney, and the guy with a bunch of enthusiastic young people that he's proven, that Ron Paul has proven he's got some very people who really trust and believe in him and will be out there doing what has to be done. And those are the two people who either had the money or the troops on the ground who are volunteers to get it done. The other guys didn't do it. Now, you know, I have some questions about, and Al and I were talking earlier before the program started about the way the primary is structured and the way it probably it could be done better, and it would be useful for party politics if it was. But the rules are the rules, and I think everybody knew. Nobody didn't know the rules.
And they've been around for a long
forever.
Time. This is not a surprise that was popped.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny because, I mean, this was a U.S. Appellate court ruling. This is in response to a U.S. District Court judge that said, hey, you waited too long to, you know, challenge the rule. You should have done this a long time ago. If there was even a thought you were going to run for president. And by the way, all three members of the appellate court agreed unanimously that this is not challengeable, that they were just, for lack of a better term, just crap out of luck. Ralph?
What has the court said about putting together a write-in strategy, similar to what, say, Lisa Murkowski was able to effectively accomplish get back into the Senate?
Well, the election laws in Virginia do not allow for write-in.
Okay.
So a write-in candidate is not going to garner any favor. They're not going to qualify for the GOP delegates according to current Commonwealth election law.
Right.
So when we look at this, I mean, is this just another nail in the coffin for Rick Perry and Newt Gingrich as they go up head-to-head versus
Mitt
Romney?
Not as though he needed any.
Al.
These guys already have too many nails in their coffin. Let's face it, the Virginia law is anachronistic. It needs to be changed. But it's been around a long time. Everybody knew. People have dealt with it. And three guys, four guys, five people came up short with it. And it's embarrassing to them. It's also a little bit embarrassing to Virginia that they have a set of rules that are so rigid. I think you'll see these rules change so that Virginia can be, if the opportunity presents itself, relevant in this process. My own hunch is that this issue is going to, that the issue of the nomination is going to be resolved before we get to the Virginia primary, so it won't matter anyway. But under some circumstances, it could. this year it won't matter. If by any chance things are still open and going by the time we get to Virginia, it won't matter. And it could have mattered, and that's why they will change the law.
But when we look at changing the law and we look at the judge's comments of saying, look, even long shot candidates in the past, I mean, these are election laws that have been in place for decades.
Yep.
Even the most obscure candidates have been able to get on the ballot. Why aren't major campaigns able to move forward and get their requirements set up and going forward?
They've been too busy fighting with each other.
Yeah. Bob, is that accurate, you think?
I think so, but let's step back for a moment and talk about something more fundamental. Consider this. A primary where only your party can vote always helps to do one thing.
What's that?
It gives more authority and power long-term than you might like to the most organized and disciplined part of the group, which is either, if you're a Democrat, it's the wing nuts on the left. On the Republican side, it's the wing nuts on the right. Now, what that says is, and there are now, example, New Hampshire's primary is a very interesting primary. New Hampshire's primary is a Republican primary. But if you are a registered independent, you can vote in the primary, either Republican or the Democratic primary. You can vote in it. Now, what does that do? That helps to put more people, to give more moderate voters, people who are not identified strongly with either party, a chance to influence each party's nomination. Now, parties may say, oh my God, that means, you know, we might get the wrong kind of people, blah, blah, blah. But the truth of the matter is, what it does is it helps to ensure that at least some moderates in the parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, are going to have more of a chance to get elected than just some wingnuts on the left or the right. And I would suggest that the biggest problem with the Virginia primary, and in many primaries in many states, is not the requirements that are strict. As Al says, we've all said, everybody knew what they were. It's the structure of the primaries which does not advantage moderates who want to solve problems, and nearly as it advantages wingnuts who want to be ideologically pure.
But regardless of that, I mean, Alan, go ahead.
I hear what he's saying, but I'm looking at the result in Virginia. He's talking about how it advantages the wingnuts. The only two people that qualified are Mitt Romney and Ron Paul. Now, nobody's really, people haven't been calling Romney a wingnut.
And he's not.
And he's not. And Ron Paul, some people think is. Some people obviously passionately believe in
him. At least
him.
10,000 people in the Commonwealth of Virginia think he's not a wingnut.
And Virginia, well, or maybe they do, but maybe he's their kind of wingnut. So who knows? And Virginia also allows people to cross over in the primary. Democrats can go show up on primary day and vote Republican. You just have to ask for the Republican ballot. I think what this is shining a light on is that, A, you better know the rules and you better get your ducks in a row and get yourself onto ballots, and it speaks to this basic fundamental organizational question. Well, those are the rules. And Virginia's are outdated. They probably need to be changed. Among other things, it's not entirely impossible that you could have another candidate. You could have some force. You could have General David Petraeus, who suddenly people get behind, or Michael Bloomberg of New York says, "I'm in," and everybody suddenly there's a burst of enthusiasm for him, and people say, "We need to be able to get him on ballots." And you'd like to think that the system would allow for an unconventional, an unexpected candidate to actually get on ballots and qualify if he's got a national following of some kind. That can't happen in Virginia. I don't know enough about other states and whether it can happen in some states or shouldn't. But there ought to be room for that. But
well,
you know that? You know, the court case? What's the surprise?
But
the law is clear. The district court decided. The appellate court decided. No surprise whatsoever there. And now it'll be up to the state to have to figure out whether they want to change their rules.
Let's look at the responsibility. I mean, if they were to get on the ballot now, let's look at the workload that would have to go into that by the local supervisor of elections. I mean, you're talking about having to halt an entire process that is written in law. I mean, they have elections laws that they have to follow. And for a candidate, and a great, great demonstration of my point is a quote coming out of the decision, and the quote reads, quote, "Once a candidate learned he had been denied a place on the ballot, he would take his disappointment to the courthouse, and hapless state election boards would be forced to halt their scheduled election process to wait for a ruling." That's not necessarily fair to the election boards and the supervisors of elections in those jurisdictions.
Nobody's saying it is. That's the current law. Yeah. I'm saying that what Virginia has created for itself is a formula to not be relevant this year.
Right.
And why even bother to have a primary if it's got a system that's likely to make it irrelevant?
But
so it can change its law to be more relevant, not to create problems for local election boards, but to be more relevant, more current, and I think that's going to happen, but not for this time around, for the future.
And if Virginia changes their election laws, is it likely that they'll want to move their primary further ahead to be more relevant?
That's a whole separate issue. Right.
Work against each other. But let's look at what I do want to look at, your comment about making Virginia irrelevant. Yeah. I think, if anything, it makes Virginia more relevant, one could argue, by saying, look, this is something that a shot-in-the-dark candidate that comes out of nowhere, I mean, it could have easily been somebody like Donald Trump or Michael Bloomberg, somebody with a lot of money that could have done this. This takes out the serious players from the shot-in-the-dark candidates.
Right.
I think it makes it very relevant.
No. What you've got now is you've got a primary in Virginia that will pit Mitt Romney against Ron Paul, regardless of what is happening in the Republican Party during that time. That's why I say it's irrelevant. If Gingrich gets up ahead of steam, if Gingrich surprised people in South Carolina and Florida, and Santorum drops out and Perry drops out, and suddenly you've got Mitt as the main non-Rom, as they say, and a serious guy, he can't get on the ballot in Virginia. And I don't know, and I think that's why I say, so Virginia would be irrelevant to that effect.
Al, you agree with that?
I see what he's getting at. The reason for states that are trying to have theirs earlier and earlier and earlier is so that they will have more impact on the final decision.
Sure.
And what he is saying is, if you have your election laws set up so that you can end up as they have with just two candidates, it's not a broad enough field for you to have a whole lot of impact on the overall primary process.
And you'll probably have a lot of protest voting from the Gingrich and Santorum.
How?
Just writing the name in.
Well, you can't write in Virginia. There's no ability for you to write in Virginia. That's
not
issue.
Even on the ballot.
No,
nothing.
There's no write-in capacity.
Those people will probably have to vote for Paul.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, that would be that
or
would
just
be
not
that.
Vote.
They won't vote.
They won't vote.
They won't
vote.
Be there.
All right.
They won't go. They won't. That's irrelevance.
But there is one other option. Now, just because the appellate court, now through the court system, they do have the ability to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. The question is, do you think that Newt Gingrich, do you think Rick Perry will go to the U.S. Supreme Court with this? Al?
Well, I have no idea. They look, this is like the guy who forgot to file. That has happened. You know, somebody got so involved in that he forgot to go down and pay his money and file. Too bad. You're out of the game. So I think that...
I cannot imagine either one of those gentlemen going to the Supreme Court of the United States. They've got a lot of other problems that are a lot more serious than getting on the Virginia ballot.
You think that this is the end of the road for that argument?
I do. I do. I think this is it.
It's the end of the road one way or the other.
Yeah.
They may appeal. I cannot for the life of me imagine the Supreme Court saying, oh, yeah, we're going to stick our nose in here. We got two courts
underneath us.
The law is very clear. And I think that that's what bugs me about this.
And we stuck our nose into Florida, so enough's enough.
Yeah.
Wow, bringing up 2000 again, huh? Really? Really?
Boy.
Imagine the Democrat bringing up Florida. Yeah, imagine that.
They sure bailed out Florida from its embarrassment.
But bottom line here is that is this a wake-up call to future presidential campaigns that say, look, you know, we've got to focus not on getting super PAC ads out there, not on getting attack messages out there. The first line of business to make sure we're on the ballot in all 50 states, Bob, is that an accurate analysis?
Let's put it this way. A sensible campaign, the first thing you would do next to, you know, discovering whether you have any sugar daddies to help you in your super PAC is to know what the campaign laws are in every state of the union. That's about as basic as you can get. And the research is so damn easy, a first-year law student could do it.
Yeah. I'm not even a lawyer, and I used to do it on campaigns. I don't understand how this is.
Did any of your candidates win?
Yes.
Well, you see, you did a good job.
But this is just simple politics 101.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you're going to try and win the nomination, you got to make sure that you are in the game in all 50 states. Yeah. And for some reason, this just fell short. It's mind-boggling.
And there are a large number of people that are looking for an alternative to Romney. But at this point, they failed to coalesce behind one single conservative alternative. And the main reason is because the conservatives tend to be very disorganized and can't get on the ballot in the states.
I think future candidates are going to learn what Virginia's rules are.
Absolutely.
Especially Republican candidates.
And I would agree with Alan that probably Virginia may well take a look at changing its rules.
Well, we're gonna take a quick break here. When we come back, we're gonna talk about the Congress approval rating numbers. Congress is coming back in this week. We're gonna come back and talk about what Congress has to look forward to in about 3 minutes. This is Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us. We'll be back in 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Radio. Joining me as they do every Tuesday for our second and final hour is Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Undersecretary Alan Moore, the Honorable Bob Hines, and Dr. Ralph Winnie. I am Radio's Justin Russell, moderating this group of pundits, and we're going to kick off the second and final hour talking about Congress. And not that we need to find new stuff to talk about Congress, but they're coming back into the fold. They're coming back to work this week. And they are coming back to work with record low approval ratings. According to a poll that was released today by ABC, it looks like that they are now floating somewhere around 11% approval rating, which is ungodly bad for a seated Congress. And this following the comment by Senate Leader Harry Reid on Meet the Press on Sunday, saying that this is the most productive Congress in history, which I tweeted over the weekend. I'd love to see how that's possible, kids. I really, really would, but he stands by. In fact, he made it a point to say it not just once, but four or five times during his interview on Meet the Press. But, you know, the bottom line here is that there are so many issues facing Congress, but the biggest question is, with it being an election year, a contested election year, and there's a lot of divisiveness in the country right now, have we seen the worst of what could possibly happen in Congress, or is the worst yet to come? This is a big, big deal. I want to start with the question is, does it surprise you, Bob, and I know we've talked about this before on the radio show, but does it surprise you that the numbers are that low approving of Congress?
It doesn't surprise me that it's that low because of the way the Congress has done what they've done. I suppose if I were Harry Reid, I would say it's the most successful Congress because we have avoided disaster so many times. But the fact of the matter is, that's really all they've done. They have, in effect, avoided disaster. They've gotten about as close as you can get on several occasions and avoided it. But the fact of the matter is, we haven't done very much.
Well, I would argue it has been a disaster. If I were running for re-election, I would be scared to death. And I can't understand why more incumbents aren't doing what John Dingell has done. And that is issue two, very well-reasoned and articles in the Washington Post, plus a very funny poem that he put out. Yes. You know, to separate himself from the yeah. people that are just doing the fist fighting, you know, behind the rail. So I think every single incumbent, one. Depending on how redistricting has gone and affected this, but every single incumbent should, I think, consider himself vulnerable.
Well, and consider this. Given the fact that we have had a redistricting, which a number of members of the House are more challenged, if you will, than they would have been in a normal election, and given the fact that it's going to be, I think most people would believe that their candidate for president is not a shoo-in, whoever a Republican is. We know who the Democratic nominee is going to be. And neither one of them, are going to be hugely popular. It's going to be every man or woman for himself, so to speak. And I suspect there's going to be an awful lot of short weeks and people being back home as much as they can do. And I don't think you're going to see a whole lot of creative legislation on a lot of issues that are not absolutely have to be addressed.
Alan, do you agree with Bob? I mean, is this more of a dog and pony show than it is an actual legislative body right now?
Well, they have some things they have to do. And one of the first things they have to do is pick up the mantle of this two-month spending bill that they passed in December and figure out what they're going to do for the next 10 months of the year. That's a biggie. That is going to be enormously challenging. When we talk about 84% disapproval of the Congress, and I don't know, 11% approval, and other people don't know, don't care, who knows? I'm kind of curious as to why anybody approves at this point. But other than people who would say anything they do is bad, so doing nothing is good. Having said that, the president doesn't get to run against Congress, although he's annoying Republicans and Democrats by trying to run against Congress. He's going to have to run against another candidate, and that other candidate is going to run against both the president and Congress. So it's still an interesting open question. The Congress will get the critical decisions made to keep government limping along. No new directions are going to be established of any great moment over the course of this year, because it's going to be all about the November elections.
But Al, when you were a seated member of Congress for 8 terms, you spent 16 years as a member. You spent many years prior to that as a staffer on the Hill. Do you see any possibility of there not just being a total colossal logjam in the second half of the 112th Congress?
Well, if they've got a brain in their head, that is the worst possible thing the incumbents could do. They really need to come out with this and deal with those basic things that Alan has mentioned. At least, at a minimum, they have to do that. I also agree with Alan that they're not likely to do anything more than that. But if they don't, the incumbents are out of their minds.
And I think there's a possibility you could see more third-party candidates jump into various congressional races if public opinion continues to look unfavorably on Congress.
Well, let's look at the Congress right now, the 112th. Al, you were talking about there not being anything large going through this Congress session. Apparently, Congressman Jeff Flake, who's running for the Senate in Arizona, agrees. Our friends out at Politico, particularly Scott Wong, has a great, great article about the 5 issues that could defy gridlock in the 112th Congress session. Jeff Flake is quoted as saying, "I think it will be tough to move anything big through this environment," quote unquote. And he's not the only one. There are others that are feeding into that sentiment as well. Is it possible that they're just going to write off the second half of the 112th Congress and just say that, you know what, we've got other things to worry about? For example, like getting reelected or stumping for an incumbent president?
I think they have to. I think they have to get something done in order to get reelected. Those basic things that I just mentioned and that Alan articulated just a little while ago. I think they've got to get at least that done to have anything to stand on besides a soapbox to get reelected.
Bob?
We've all said the same thing, and I think we're all right. They're going to be doing, for all kinds of reasons, they're going to be doing just what has to be done. They have to deal with the budget for next year. They have to deal with the tax the next 10 months on the tax payroll tax deal. There are a couple of pieces of major legislation that need to be reauthorized, and I think once you get past that, I think that's all the time they're going to have.
But the problem is most of those are things that they have been fighting about for the whole rest of the Congress.
Yeah, well, but
where they're
exactly
going to find the comedy, I'm not sure.
There's, remember, there's we're almost into February. The 2 month deal runs out in February. Then there's just about 8 months left for this fiscal year, and that's how these spending bills run from October 1 to September 30th. Sometime on or around September, so they have to decide what to do for the remaining 8.5 months of this year, and then they have to decide what to do from October 1st until some point into the new year. Now, in the old days, it would have been the next fiscal year, all the way up to September 30th of 2013. My guess is this year they'll have some kind of a continuing spending bill, like we've done now for several years running, on or around October 1. We'll probably punt it into maybe post the November election and have to bring people back. And there is some potential, small potential for a bigger deal if enough people decide that it's in their interest, and this would be Republicans and Democrats, to get a bigger deal. There's one big point hanging out there that could, not likely to, but could prompt this, and that is at the end of this year, at the end of 2012, the extension of what are typically referred to as the Bush-era tax cuts expires. So come January 1, 2013, all the Bush, this big tax bill that people talk about for the giveaway to the rich, giveaway to everybody, it will expire. And something will have to be done on or around at the end of this year to either extend the cuts, those changes, or to modify them. And it's in the interest of many people to not just wait until January 1 and let all hell break loose.
And remind yourself that assuming that the payroll tax deduction is continued for another 10 months, it's also going to be running out at the same time.
It'll run out September 30th.
Yeah. There's going to be all kind of stuff.
So there's going to be some things that have to get done late in the year.
Congressman Al.
This intrigues me, and I don't know whether any of you guys have any insight on this at all. I haven't read any much in the board, but it will be very interesting in what these guys have been hearing while they've been home and whether that has made any changes in their approach to it or not. It would seem to me that if they were listening, they would hear an enormous amount of anger not at Republicans or Democrats, but at congressmen, at incumbents.
Yeah, right.
And that may make a few incumbents rethink their approach. Well, I don't know. Have you heard anything on that?
Scott Wong's piece in Politico yesterday, talking about the five things that will define gridlock. There are five issues that will come up that will just push the logjam aside. One of them is tax reform. With the failure of the super committee, is tax reform something that could get bipartisan support, and could we see large-scale legislation? Bob, you're shaking your head no. You disagree.
I don't think that in an election year you're going to be able to redraft the tax law. There are too many issues that each party feels too strongly about for us to be able to do it.
You don't think the Ways and Means Committee that's been working on this will come up with anything?
I would not be surprised if the Ways and Means Committee didn't have a bill or at least a proposal in front of them that they're looking at. But I cannot see it getting to the floor of the House and the Senate and with all the debate that would go on, because the changes are going to have to be substantial.
But wouldn't it make sense, at least in the eyes of the general electorate here in the United States, for them to, as Senator Rob Portman from Ohio said in this piece, it would be good policy to build on what the super committee attempted to do in the last session of the Congress?
I think it would be excellent if they could build on that or on Bowles Simpson or either one of those proposals. But what I'm saying is it ain't going to happen.
Well, remember, when we say build upon, we can talk about some steps in a process. Finishing the building? No. Some additional progress? Maybe.
Okay. What about, for example, you're looking at infrastructure. Infrastructure, according to Scott Wong's piece, is going to be something that Congress could possibly do something big, like passing the $60 billion infrastructure jobs bill that did last fall. There's another set of legislation that could be possible to make infrastructure a bipartisan, defy the logjam type situation.
Absolutely, if they can find the money.
Yeah.
Or a major calamity happening. Then they would be sort of forced
well,
into that position.
If a bridge fell down again, I suppose. But you're still finding the money.
Yeah.
There are all kinds of ways we could spend our way out of this situation.
Yeah.
And but I don't think you could pass the spending bills.
I don't think you could pass a big infrastructure bill unless you had a fund some funding. And I don't think we don't have any money. We're broke, right now. We're out of money basically. We need more revenue. And
we're not going to raise the gas tax.
We're not going to raise. We're probably not going to raise the gas tax. We're probably not going to start changing some of the entitlements or some of the programs in the tax bill that need to be reformed to raise revenues. And I doubt we're going to get into it deep enough to build a support system for a big revenue expenditure on infrastructure.
Could there be bipartisan support for something that Speaker Boehner has talked about, getting revenue for oil drilling leases?
It would be nice, but I doubt it.
Al, do you agree on the Democratic side?
Yeah, I do. I think anything that requires spending, and there are a lot of solutions out there if we had the money, and we don't. And so I don't see them going anywhere. Good ideas that would come from either the Republicans or the Democrats that are going to be dead on arrival because we haven't got the money.
Alan.
Yeah, I think we've, for better or worse, both sides are sort of entrenched right now. And that's why we're in a waiting game through much of this year, which is an unfortunate way to spend a year of our lives, of all of us in America. But both sides have drawn these lines in the sand, and I think the only way we break out of there is, as Ralph suggested, if some disaster occurs, or if we have the results of an election known, and we say for a period of time, well, this is what we've got. We've got Obama for 4 more years. Let's deal with it and start making some decisions. Or we've got a new person for 4 years. It's time to, and we've got whatever changes will have occurred in the Congress. There are always surprises. Let's see if we can't come together and be willing to make some compromises, because the disaster that's most likely to catch up to us is an explosion in interest rates. We're still waiting for it. It hasn't come. We're still the safest place in the world for money, which is just a pure piece of good fortune and good luck. So interest rates are still low. If interest rates were to move in a big way, that would touch everybody's life and would cause members of Congress to say, oh my God, I never thought this would occur. Wow, we really do have to cut spending more over here and in ways we never intended. And others on the taxes would say, we really do have to reform the tax system. We really do have to find some more revenue. I don't see that happening. I actually hope that doesn't happen, because I think that would only, in this year, result from a major disaster that would be a negative for everybody.
Bob.
On that same point that Alan makes, what is more likely to be true, and I want to get, you jump in on that, Bill, because it strikes me that, everything you read about with the euro and the European Union is not very positive. You know, they quote thought they had a deal, they, you know, 3 weeks ago. Well, they've not been able to pull it together. Greece is about to go belly up. Italy is in, you know, is and both Spain have been recently have been able to float their bond.
Last week Moody's downgraded the credit rating to double A.
So the reality is that Europe is going to have European reality is going to have a serious impact on our economy.
Yeah, it has a
they can't buy
impact.
Stuff.
Well,
they can't afford to buy stuff.
Direct impact on American exports.
Well, you're also looking at, you know, you look at China. China's GDP is going to drop for the first time in 2012. That's an anticipation. But when we look at domestic issues here, does the XL pipeline have legs to get bipartisan support and get that through? Alan?
I don't think so. I think that the Republicans may have overplayed their hand here by putting a mere 60-day time frame on the president. It makes it easy for him to say, gosh, I kind of like the potential of this timeline, but 60 days when we're going back to take another hard look, if I have to decide in 60 days, I have to say no. Even though I love the potential for this project, so don't blame me. Blame the Republicans who just unilaterally imposed an impossible deadline on
them.
Having said that, be ready for the Republicans to extend the deadline if it comes to that.
But, Alan, I mean, is that fair? I mean, you know, you've been involved in energy issues during your tenure as a congressman. Does the argument against the XL pipeline have any merit to it? Is the timeline the killer?
Well, I agree with Alan that this Congress continues to find a little light at the end of the tunnel and then blow it up.
Blows it out.
And then blow it up. But it's something that could be done, I suppose. I doubt it.
Well, it's a catch-22 for the members of Congress. On the one hand, they don't want to touch anything controversial involving spending or revenue, but at the same time, they have to be doing something to convince the American people that they're deserving of being reelected, given the low approval rating that the Americans have for members of Congress.
But the other issue is that we're looking at is health reform. Health reform is getting a little bit of play with Republicans. Republicans are going back to that 1972 idea of possibly coming up with a universal health care program that is amenable to everybody. Is there the opportunity in Congress this session, this to close out the 112th, to come up with some large-scale uniform health care reform? Bob, you're shaking your head no.
I don't see any possibility of anything substantive happening on an issue that is so controversial.
Or one on which the Democrats have placed so much emphasis.
Exactly.
Is that, Alan?
Absolutely. The Democrats are all in on the current law and the current program. Now, we are going to get a Supreme Court decision sometime this year, which will speak to the question of whether the individual mandate is constitutional. My guess is that they will find that it is, but I don't know. And if they say that it's not, then sort of all hell will break loose. But all hell will break loose in a way that says we have got to come back early next year then to figure out what we have, what we don't have, who's president, who's not. There's a lot of things that are in the pipeline, moving down the line, coming into being in 2013 and 2014, and do we want to throw all of that out? Because the Supreme Court decision won't throw everything out. It will throw out a key piece that may make some of the other things unworkable, but it will be a mad scramble. But that's the only action event that I see right now. I don't see any movement in the Congress to come together. They're all waiting on the court to decide on whether this key element of the president's plan is legal or not.
All right. Well, we're coming up on a break right now. When we come back, we're going to continue the discussion of Congress coming back into closing out the 112th Congress and what they can possibly do, if anything can be done. And we're going to touch a little bit about what really needs to happen. A couple of strange ideas have come out recently on how to possibly reform Congress and get their numbers up. We'll talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. And we're in continued discussion on the 112th Congress coming back into town to finish up the last half of their congressional session and the low approval ratings that are coming out. As of this morning, Congress is walking back into the office buildings on Capitol Hill with an 11% approval rating. Record low approval ratings for Congress. Even they didn't think they could screw it up that badly. But when we look at what's going on, you know, during the break we had a little sidebar discussion about the possibility of there being third party contenders. What could a new Congress look like? We've already seen a number of incumbents announce that they're not going to be seeking re-election, notably on the Democratic side, Barney Frank, for example. And they continue to drop like flies in today's political environment due to redistricting, due to low popularity ratings, for a multitude of reasons. The latest one to come out today was the gentleman from Pennsylvania, Todd Platts. Todd Platts announced today that he will not be seeking re-election. And more likely, that'll probably be a combination of redistricting and low approval ratings. So when we look at this, are we going to see more of a possible third party, or what could the next Congress look like? Al?
I have no idea, except I think it's something that we should be thinking about because there are so many different things playing on it. Redistricting is one. Redistricting, for example, in my state and in my old congressional district, Bob and I are great fans of having nonpartisan committees do this. Well, it didn't work in my state. What they did with my district, which was a swing district, slightly leaning Democratic, always moving toward the Republicans, and it's split by I-5, you know, the highway. And west of that is liberal. East of that is conservative. So what did they do? They took the east part and put it into a Republican district and left Rick Larson with all the Democrats. So, you know,
all that proves, Al, is that there is no solution for redistricting that is always right.
Well, no, of course it's not. But the point I'm making, we don't know what redistricting is going to do. Who's gone, and who comes in, and will they be typical Republicans, the whole range, or typical Democrats, the whole range, or will people be so disgusted that there will be a lot of independent candidates that will run, many of whom might, in a normal year, not have a prayer, and in this year might do very well.
Well,
if they get here and they're virgins and they don't know how the place works, but they'll probably be idealists, and do we just end up with a whole bunch of different kinds of Tea Party?
One of the things we know for sure is some very senior members are probably not going to be coming back.
Like in California, with Elson Gallagher and David Dreyer. And that's a real travesty for
Jerry
California.
Lewis. Maybe Brad Sherman or Henry Bierman.
Well, we look at Texas. We've got Charlie Gonzalez not coming back.
We've got some very senior members, and some of those members are very important parts of the system, and most of them are more sensible than some of the people who are not retiring. I mean, David Dreyer, as an example, is one of the finest members in the House. I think either party would say this guy is the kind of a guy we need, and there's almost no way he has no district to run in.
But Alan, we said before, I mean, the thought of having a large third party influx into a new Congress, there's just no way. If we think gridlock's bad now, the thought of a coalition government in Congress is just mind-boggling. Is that a reality, or is that something that we may have to look forward to and adjust appropriately?
It isn't going to happen. I mean, the place where there has been the biggest interest, the biggest movement in a third-party candidacy is at the national level. There was some smart people from both parties raised a lot of money looking for a candidate to be a third-party force, and they can't find a candidate. They got the dough. They've got credibility. They've got ideas. They've got polls that say a pox on both their houses. Let's find somebody else. They can't find a candidate. And if they did have a candidate, he would be ripped to shreds by the media and by the other candidates. So that whole effort, which people have been talking about for a long time and raised something like $30 million to support it, not chump change, is going nowhere. And if you think you can't do it at that level, who's the third party force? If at the local level, you're much more likely to have primary opponents within the party who want to take after incumbents. That's where the new ones come from. That's where they came from 2 years ago. And that's where what some of the people are worried about now. People like Dick Lugar in Indiana, a senator of, I think, five terms, maybe six, who is really, really respected for foreign policy knowledge, has a huge following nationally, Republicans and Democrats. He's got a fight on his hands for a primary. So that's where the change will occur, not from some third party force.
Now, I think Alan is probably right. But what I am saying is possible is no third party, just a whole bunch of individuals with different views that locally are able to take over. And then they get here, and then do they form a third party? Well, some are going to be very right, some are going to be very left, is what I did. Or are they just going to be loose cannons that will roll around the floor of the House and screw everything up?
Well, Bob, history says there won't be a third party. There'll be just what Alan said. There'll be a lot of new people maybe coming in. And what Al said, they're going to just be loose cannons wandering around. Now, hopefully, some of the newer members who will be coming back, maybe they'll be a little more responsible, let's put it that way, trying to find solutions. So maybe there won't be quite as many newer members this time come in that are really loose cannons like we had in the 2 years ago when we had 75 or 80 Republicans coming in. We had a lot of loose cannons who are still very loose cannons. And
be
I think...
devoutly be with
you. Yeah.
But again, you know, when we look at the loose cannons and everything, there's a push on the Hill by some, and there's an article, again, our friends from Political, thank you for putting this up. There's a there's an article that posted yesterday from Representative Ribble, who's a Republican from Wisconsin, and Representative Rigel from Virginia, talking about how they feel they could reform Congress. Some of these ideas we talked about, for example, they talk about term limits. We all agree that term limits aren't exactly the right thing to do because then staff runs Congress. But one of the things they do talk about is no congressional pensions. Should Congress not get their pension? I mean, theoretically, there's a lot of money to be saved in congressional pensions. Al, I would hate to think about taking money out of your pocket, but is that a reality?
Well, I don't think they could go back and take my pension away. That would be retroactive. But I don't see where that helps anything. What congressmen get paid, what their pensions are, and all of it doesn't have anything to do with what's wrong with Congress. What's wrong with Congress is they've forgotten that they're here to solve problems, and that they need to understand that the way you solve problems in a democracy is you compromise.
But are they here to solve problems, or are they here to legislate? Alan.
Well, yeah, when Al says they've forgotten, in order to forget something, you have to know it in the first place. But it's up to the American people to hold them accountable.
A lot of the new guys.
Let me just reemphasize how right he is.
The new guys came with a different agenda. They said the Congress is corrupt and wrong, and its priorities are totally askew. We're going to change things. Well, what they were able to do was gum up the works. And there were a lot of decisions that have been made and a lot of bad behavior and bad practices that we can look at that fed the mindset of self-dealing and bad decision-making. But the overwhelming force in all of this was an economy in the toilet. It stayed in the toilet. It took us a long time to get into the mess, and things just fell apart very rapidly and have stayed bad. And the public says, they have failed us. We don't want to blame ourselves for our consumerism or buying too big a house. We're going to blame somebody, and the Congress and the White House, the federal government is a great big target. State and local governments, they're a medium-sized target, and we don't like them either. That's a subject we talked about much earlier. So when things are really bad and you don't want to say, I am the problem or I am even a part of the problem, you want to blame somebody. And the government, God knows, at all levels, has provided ample ammunition, a great big target to be part of the problem.
They should have. Alan is right, but sometimes when I listen to somebody bitch and moan and wheeze about the Congress, I like to just point out, somebody sent them here. You know, and I think sometimes it's arrogance if a politician proposes it. Some columnists have suggested it. But the public has a responsibility. The public has a responsibility to choose people that they think have real merit, and they've been running off chasing extreme ideas or anybody that promises them that I'll just fix it. And it's you can't just fix it. You got to have ideas. You got to have theories and whatever. And I think that the public needs to understand that they are part of this system. And every single member of Congress was sent here by the public. And the public should look at themselves a little bit when they wonder, how did all of these strange people get there?
Well, this goes back to a topic that we've talked about before. There's almost an inherent complacency with the general electorate of saying, well, we sent him there, whatever he does, he does. Hopefully he'll have our best interests in mind. You're almost, Al, to kind of paraphrase what you're saying, is there almost has to have a resurgence of the individual electorate to retake back the responsibility of who they put into office.
And Bob, go ahead.
But if the party keeps is structured so, and the primaries are structured so, that the likely nominees of either party are more to the left on the Democratic side and more to the right on the Republican side, rather than being more moderate, what we're going to continue to get is the kind of people we've been getting in the last couple of elections.
Now,
I give lectures occasionally to students at the universities, and one of the things I point out is that the United States Congress is what it should be. It reflects the public. And it is a very human institution, and it behaves much like we do. People start lobbying when they're about 2 years old. Mommy, mommy, I want to buy this candy at the checkout stand.
Right.
You know? And mommy says no, and the kid has a tantrum and what have you. A group of people say, let's go to a movie, and then they start negotiating which movie they're going to go to. That every single American is a politician, even though they don't know they're practicing politics, they do it all the time. It's how human beings get along with each other.
Well, the problem is, in Congress, you don't get rewarded for working with the other side. You're vilified by your own party. You get points for attacking the other side.
You are exactly right, but let me add, there's no positive reinforcement in the system. You know, if you take a tough stand, you are usually vilified. Now, I remember my mail, and every once in a while I get a letter praising these guys for the enormous courage that it must have taken for me to vote a certain way. It was always on an easy vote. Everybody agreed with it. You know, so they thought I had courage. Now, when once in a while I took a courageous vote, one that I knew was going to not settle well back home, I got no letters on my courage. I remember one letter that began, Al Swift, you goddamn son of a bitch. And then it went on to tell me what they thought I'd done wrong.
Well, let me ask you a question, Al, reflecting on your experience, because there's a lot of feeling out there, a lot of thought among people in America that congressmen only do things based on what the political landscape suggests. They hold up their finger to the wind and maybe pay attention to their, especially their district back home. What's going to help me? What's going to hurt me? What I'd like for you to comment on is the extent to which you thought this is what makes the most sense, and gosh, is it going to be a problem for me back home? Is it going to help me or is it going to hurt me? And how big was that a factor? How much is in your mind and your experience, your exposure, how much is the doing the right thing, the best thing, a factor for members of Congress versus, and how much of it is reduced by, gosh, is this going to help or hurt?
I think it varies with the issue, and I'll use myself as an example. I told myself when I was thinking of running for Congress, if you're going to take on the NRA, you might as well forget.
Uh-huh.
because mine is a district of hunters and sportsmen, and every yard sign in my first three campaigns were made by union members from one company, and the only thing they needed to know was I for gun laws. And I wasn't, so therefore they produce the things. Now the fact is, I don't think there's much wrong with gun laws, and I vote for many, but I didn't. So I gave on that. Another example, right now, as we see here, they're tearing down a dam in the Olympic National Park. The local community didn't want to tear it down. It supplied all the power for the major employer in that district, and it provided the clean water for the whole city of Port Angeles. And when I'm trying to make this not a long story, it's a three-volume story. I'll make it short. I came to the conclusion after several things had happened that in fact the dam was coming down, that it didn't come down one way, the environmentalists were going to sue, and it would come down by the courts. And the courts don't have the tools legislatures have. And so I proposed and fought for and went back time and time again and argued with my own people that this was in their best interest, because otherwise it would go to court and there'd be no way a court could get that electricity to that plant, and it would be questionable whether it would protect their water supply. So we finally got that bill passed, and they're now tearing down that thing, and they're spending $30 million on the plant to keep the water pure. And the legislature, the Congress, had the authority to say, and Bonneville Power will provide, as what they call it, a DSI, a direct service industry, to the mill, which no court could have done. So I happened that instance to be right, but yeah, I know I'm talking too long. I happen to be right, but the point was I had to sit there and argue with my own constituents time. Every time I'd go there, I'd convince them, and then when I went back, they were unconvinced, and I had to go back and convince them all over again, and it works out. So when are you a coward? Well, when you say, I'm not going to take on the whole NRA in a district like mine. When are you a courageous congressman? When you really feel that one of your cities is in terrible danger of making an awful mistake, and it's worth losing all the votes in that area to make that happen. So it varies.
Right, right. Well, we're gonna keep an eye on what's going on, and obviously this is going to be something that we're going to be talking about well into many shows this year. But one of the things I do want to point out, there's about, 40 or 50 Marines here in Shelley's back room with us. Semper Fi, boys! There we go. Joining us from the U.S. Marine Corps, let's go with Second Lieutenant Aaron. Aaron, how you doing? Welcome here, Lieutenant.
I'm doing well. How are you?
Lieutenant, why are you guys here today?
We're celebrating one of our last nights that we'll all be together. Our class is graduating from the basic school in Quantico. It's a six-month officer training program, and everybody's getting ready to head to their units, so it's one of our last nights together.
So this is the last hurrah before you guys graduate, move on to your field units, and serve the country best. First of all, on behalf of everybody here at Backroom Politics, on behalf of all of our listeners, thank you very much for your service. We really appreciate all you guys do.
Absolutely.
You guys actually make the ultimate sacrifice for all of us, and we cannot thank you enough. So, Aaron, thank you very much, Lieutenant. Thanks for joining us. Thanks. Enjoy Shelley's back room.
Thank you.
Because trust me, in about 2 minutes, the second we go off the air, they're going to get loud. So, congratulations on graduation. Enjoy your. Where are you going, by the way?
Camp Pendleton in California.
Oh, wow. Oh, you're going deep Marine Corps. There we go.
You got a good deal.
Yeah, no kidding.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, it's time for Tell Me a Story. Watch this. Semper Fi! It doesn't get any better patriotic than that. When we come back, it's Tell Me a Story here on Backroom Politics. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio, live from Shelley's Backroom. We'll be right back. of graduating Marine officers going off to their units. Cannot tell them how much we appreciate their service. But now it's my favorite part of the show. It's Tell Me a Story, where we talk about any of the rumor, conjecture, buzz going around the Beltway, outside the Beltway. But this is where we get to scoop some of the media outlets as best we can. This week I'm going to start with Bob. Bob, tell me a story.
The primary that comes on Saturday in South Carolina will be the last primary that is fundamentally vital to the Republican Party. And Romney will do very well. Romney will do well enough to basically be in a position where at least several of his opponents, at least one if not both, Gingrich and Santorum, will decide that they're in their last gasp.
Right.
He is going to have the nomination substantially in his hands at the close of business of the polls on Saturday this coming week.
Very good. So you think it's done after Saturday?
I think it's all but done.
Ralph, tell me a story.
Okay, if Gingrich gets the Republican nomination, there's an over 80% chance you'll see a centrist candidate enter the race as a third party.
Wow. Alan, tell me a story.
Well, I'll align myself more closely to Bob in that I think that South Carolina's big. If Romney's victory is big enough, that will finish it. I think it may go to Florida. I think Perry will drop out because he's just limping along anyway. And I think that if Santorum finishes behind Gingrich, he may drop out. Paul's still in. I think Gingrich is still in through Florida. After Florida, I think then it's a done deal. Then what we're going to see is conversations from the Romney camp about vice presidential potential. It won't be Gingrich or Perry or Bachman, obviously, or Kane. Santorum, I'm not ready to write off yet as a potential running mate, but that's when I think you're going to see a long list of people. It'll include Marco Rubio from Florida. It's going to include the two governors who stepped up early, Mitch Daniels from Indiana and Chris Christie
from
New Jersey. I think it will include Condoleezza Rice as a potential. Some of this is, here's the kind of quality people that I'm thinking about, and he will try to divert the attention there. One last thing on Romney today, he said, hey, my income tax rate was about 15%. Talk about a non-surprise. The guy has not been working in a full-time job. His income comes from investments, dividends, and capital gains. The rate is 15%. Under Romney's tax proposal, he would keep that low rate only up to $200,000 a year and allow it to increase above that.
Wow. Bob, Al, Congressman Al, tell me a story.
Kind of violates the story, but he said I could do this, and I forgot to bring my glasses, so I hope I can read it. I pulled it off the internet today.
See if that helps.
They do help a little
good.
Bit.
All right.
And the top helps. Okay. And Bob and I are each 76, so it probably relates more to Bob. News release. To help save the economy, the government will announce next month that the Immigration Department will start deporting seniors instead of illegals in order to lower the Social Security and Medicare costs. Older people are easier to catch. They will not remember how to get back home.
And by the way, they're all going to Mexico anyways. You go to Mexico once a year.
Thinking about Bob, I started to cry when I thought of that, and then it dawned on me. Oh, dear, I'll see you on the bus.
That's a good one. My story is kind of tagging on to Bob and Alan. Basically, Florida is going to be the final straw. Florida is going to be the final primary that's going to determine who's going to go head-to-head with President Obama. We're going to start seeing more GOP versus Democrat very, very quickly. That being said, we're going to cut loose right now on behalf of Congressman Al, Alan Moore, Bob Hines, Ralph Winnie. I am Radio's Justin Russell. This has been Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital.
This is sure as hell the place to be.
It is tonight. Wait, I got to do it one more time. Here we go. Watch this. Semper Fi! There we go, kids. Thanks a lot for your service, guys. Thanks for listening. We'll see you here next Tuesday. Have a good week. Bye-bye.